you might think direct file is good, but actually, you know, what should we know about it?
Well, what we should know about it is, as I mentioned, direct file is the public option for taxes.
Right.
And it's important because it allows people to file returns and simple returns directly with the IRS. So last year, the pilot program was only available in 12 states. This year, the program is open to folks living in 25 states. We hope to see and are fighting for the expansion after this season into all 50 states and recognize the tough road ahead for that. But it is a program that in its first year saved over, I believe it was 130,000 taxpayers, millions of dollars and hundreds of thousands of hours in tax preparation. And already we've seen folks flock this season to the direct file system. And in the first 2 weeks, Color of Change has been doing a lot of advocacy. We are the top referrer of traffic to direct file. And so we're already saving hundreds of thousands of dollars and thousands of hours, which is a real benefit to communities. This is a system that's like in government working for you. It is also important because the other thing that private companies have really invested in and fought so hard about is that even when you file with H&R Block, when you file with Intuit or TurboTax, like when you file with LibertyTax, that information is still going to the government, to the IRS. But now it also is housed in this private corporation that essentially uses it as a part of their business model to sell other products to you and prey on you in other ways. And so it's not a coincidence that a company like Intuit own TurboTax, which is, you know, a software platform that will take up your data. They also own QuickBooks, so they have a bunch of data on small businesses that keep their accounting in that way. They own MailChimp, and so they have information of millions of folks who join direct marketing email campaigns, and so they can link data in that way. And then also own Credit Karma. And so for those who are looking to improve their credit scores, for example, and they also then have information about, you know, Americans in that level and match this to essentially prey in different ways with different types of tax products and other banking products. And we've seen this in the expansion of fintech tax product loans that has been going crazy. Right. You know, when Cash App, for example, is telling you that you can file your taxes for free, you should assume that you are the product.
Mm-hmm.
And cutting out that corporate middleman is critical and essential for not just ensuring that families keep money in their pocket, save time that they are able to put back, spend with their kids, spend with their families, spend pursuing other things, but also is a data protection strategy as well.
We've been speaking with Portia Allen Kyle, Interim Executive Director at Color of Change. The report, Preying Preparers, How Storefront Tax Preparation Companies Target Low-Income Black and Brown Communities, can be found at colorofchange.org. Portia Allen Kyle, thank you so much for joining us this week on Counterspin.
Thanks for having me.
And that's it for Counterspin for this week. Counterspin is produced by FAIR, the National Media Watch Group based in New York. The show is engineered by Riley Baer. I'm Janine Jackson. Thanks for listening to Counterspin. Welcome to Counterspin, your weekly look behind the headlines. I'm Janine Jackson. This week on Counterspin, a number of federal agencies rushed to make clear they would be scrubbing activities and events that celebrate cultural awareness in an effort to stay on the good side of the weird new White House. Trump and his abettors' anti-discrimination agenda is as subtle as a sledgehammer. DEI hire, for instance, is super complicated code for the idea that if a person who isn't white, cis, and male got a job, that can only mean a better qualified white cis man was unfairly denied it. That's just, Trump says, common sense. The irony is not lost that history itself is seen as being manipulated for political purpose when it comes to Black History Month, because we know that history is constantly invoked, if implicitly, as a way of justifying present-day inequity. White supremacy can be presented as natural if white people invented everything, discovered everything, created all the wealth, and defined civilization. And that lies in back of many public and media conversations. So just saying, Charles Drew.
Before we get started, I'd like to remind you that the views, thoughts, and opinions expressed in this show are solely those of individuals involved and do not necessarily represent those of WRCT Pittsburgh and its members.
From New York, this is Democracy Now!
So by asking the question, tell us what you did this week, what he's doing is saying, are you actually working? And then if you don't answer, like, you're sort of semi-fired or you're fired, because a lot of people are not answering because they don't even exist.
Despite President Trump calling Elon Musk's demands of the federal workforce a pretty ingenious idea, resistance is mounting to Musk's threats, and reporters are disputing the cost-cutting claims of his so-called Department of Government Efficiency. We'll speak with a federal worker with the Department of Veterans Affairs, where more than 1,000 nurses, doctors, and other workers have already been cut. And with Stephen Engelberg, editor-in-chief of ProPublica, who writes, the Trump administration keeps citing an untrue stat as it targets federal workers. Then as Defense Secretary Pete Hegseth heads to Guantanamo amidst growing concern over sending migrants there, we'll look at the private company running its detention center there, which has a history of abuse.
Last year, the Biden administration gave a $163.4 million contract to Acoma Infrastructure Protection, a private contractor, to run the Guantanamo Migrant Detention Center. And what I discovered is that this company has also been criticized for its treatment of migrants at the other immigration jails that it runs throughout the country.
Finally, the nonprofit Dawn is filing a complaint with the International Criminal Court.
Joe Biden, Anthony Blinken, and Lloyd Austin are complicit in Israel's crimes. These officials were aware of the crimes that Israel was committing, and yet they ensured that American political support kept coming.
We'll speak to Dawn board member and veteran war crimes prosecutor Reed Brody. All that and more coming up. Welcome to Democracy Now!, democracynow.org, The War and Peace Report. I'm Amy Goodman. The United States broke from its European allies Monday, voting against United Nations resolutions calling for Russia to be held accountable on the third anniversary of its invasion of Ukraine. At the UN General Assembly, the Trump administration's envoys voted against a resolution calling for de-escalation in Ukraine and a comprehensive, just, and lasting peace. Separately, the UN Security Council adopted a U.S.-drafted resolution Monday titled The Path to Peace that does not blame Russia for invading Ukraine. UN Undersecretary General Rosemary DiCarlo spoke to the council ahead of Monday's vote.
3 years ago today, the world watched in shock as the Russian Federation launched its full-scale invasion of Ukraine, a clear violation of the UN Charter and international law. This act undermined the very foundations of the international order.
President Trump welcomed French President Emmanuel Macron to the White House Monday for talks on Ukraine, NATO, and trade. After the talks, Macron said Ukraine must be at the table for any negotiations over its future, that any peace agreement should allow for Ukrainian sovereignty, and that peace, quote, must not mean a surrender of Ukraine, unquote. Health officials in Gaza say at least 3 children froze to death overnight as hundreds of thousands of Palestinians are forced to live in tents and other makeshift shelters in the freezing cold. Palestinians say Israel continues to violate part of the ceasefire agreement requiring it to supply Gaza with mobile homes and safer shelters. On Monday, the man who's poised to become Germany's next chancellor, Friedrich Merz, said he hoped to soon welcome Israeli Prime Minister Benjamin Netanyahu to Germany, despite an arrest warrant issued against him by the International Criminal Court. His offer came as the U.S.-based nonprofit Dawn, Democracy for the Arab World Now, formally asked the ICC to investigate former Secretary of State Antony Blinken, former Defense Secretary Lloyd Austin, and former President Joe Biden for possible complicity in war crimes and crimes against humanity. The request cites the $17.9 billion worth of U.S. weapons transfers to Israel under the Biden administration. We'll have more on the ICC complaint later in the broadcast with Reed Brody, Dawn board member and veteran war crimes prosecutor. Syria's de facto leader has opened a two-day national dialogue conference on Syria's political future. About 4,000 people are attending the talks in Damascus, led by Ahmed al-Sharaa, Syria's transitional president and head of the rebel coalition that toppled longtime dictator Bashar al-Assad. On Monday, al-Sharaa pledged to work toward the establishment of a civilian state with a separation of powers and the rule of law. He also said the state would hold a monopoly on weapons. Al-Sharaa did not invite the Kurdish-led Syrian Democratic Forces, which controls large parts of northeastern Syria. The SDF is backed by the United States, but opposed by Turkey. Meanwhile, Syrians have taken to the streets to protest Israel's announcement ordering the interim government to completely demilitarize several southern Syrian provinces. The protests erupted after Israeli Prime Minister Benjamin Netanyahu said his forces would indefinitely hold Syrian territory it's occupied since Assad's fall in December. The Trump administration's revoking a policy that requires reporting when U.S.-supplied weapons are used in violation of international human rights law. The measure was imposed during Biden's tenure in response to pressure over U.S. arms supplies to Israel. Senator Bernie Sanders said Monday he'll move to block the sale of $8.5 billion in U.S. weapons to Israel. Sanders, who also fought against U.S. arms supply to Israel under President Biden, said, quote, "It would be unconscionable to provide more of the bombs and weapons Israel's used to kill so many civilians and make life unlivable in Gaza," the senator said. In Denmark, about 20 activists were arrested at the Maersk shipping company's Copenhagen headquarters Monday as they protested its role in fueling Israel's weapons supply. Among those protesting and arrested was the prominent Swedish activist Greta Thunberg.
We're currently outside Maersk, one of the biggest shipping companies in the world. The last year, only the last year, has shipped thousands of tons of military equipment to Israel to arm them during their genocide in Gaza. And we are here to demand that Maersk must stop all the transportation of weapons and weapon components to Israel. They must terminate all contracts and investment that support the genocide and occupation of Palestine.
U.S. Defense Secretary Pete Hegseth welcomed Saudi Prince Khalid bin Salman to the Pentagon Monday, pledging closer ties between the U.S. and Saudi Arabia.
We're going to pursue peace through strength and put America first. But that does not mean ignoring partnerships. And in fact, it requires greater attention to the ones that matter the most. And our partnership with Saudi Arabia matters a great deal.
Prince Khalid bin Salman's warm welcome at the Pentagon comes just days after President Trump flew to Miami to attend an investors conference hosted by Saudi Arabia's Sovereign Wealth Fund, which has a $2 billion stake in a business run by Trump's son-in-law, Jared Kushner, and which backs the LIV Golf League that holds its tournaments at Trump's properties. An independent federal oversight agency has declared efforts by Elon Musk's Doge operation to fire thousands of probationary employees to be unlawful, paving the way for them to be rehired. Hampton Dellinger, who leads the Office of Special Counsel, said he would ask the Merit Systems Protection Board to pause the firings for 45 days. Earlier this month, Trump fired Dellinger, but a federal court reversed his termination and the U.S. Supreme Court declined to overturn his reinstatement. On Monday, the Department of Veterans Affairs said it had fired another 1,400 workers, about after about 1,000 other workers were fired from the VA earlier this month. Meanwhile, the Washington Post reports the Trump administration plans to slash the Department of Housing and Urban Development in half, from about 8,300 workers to just over 4,000. Current and former employees said the cuts are likely to upend housing markets, make homes less affordable, and roil mortgage transactions. On Monday, TV screens throughout HUD's headquarters were apparently hacked to show a looped video, clearly AI-generated, portraying President Trump kissing the feet of Elon Musk. The video was labeled "Long Live the Real King." U.S. postal workers were joined by union leaders and fellow workers Monday as they rallied against Trump's reported plan to place the historically independent Postal Service under control of the Secretary of Commerce. Workers and customers warned the move could be the first step in privatizing the U.S. Postal Service, among other things that could lead to addresses in more remote rural areas not being serviced. But any major changes to the USPS would legally require congressional approval. This is Brad Renfro, president of the National Association of Letter Carriers. Union.
This administration has no interest in protecting public service, working people, or really the public good. They want to throw us away and create an unreliable, inefficient, expensive private delivery service. And what do we say to that?
The Trump administration's halted efforts to jail immigrants in tent camps at Guantanamo Bay over concerns the makeshift facilities don't meet basic detention standards. Trump officials had planned to build the tent structures to detain an anticipated 30,000 immigrants apprehended at the U.S.-Mexico border. This comes as Defense Secretary Pete Hegseth is traveling to Guantanamo today, his first visit to Guantanamo since his confirmation. Hegseth was previously based in Guantanamo, where he served as an Army National Guard. We'll have more on Guantanamo later in the broadcast. In more immigration news, the Trump administration's directed ICE, Immigration and Customs Enforcement, to track down and deport hundreds of thousands of immigrant children who came to the U.S. without their parents. When children migrate to the U.S. alone, they're usually placed in the custody of Health and Human Services and the Office of Refugees Resettlement, which are both now overseen by Robert F. Kennedy Jr., raising concerns from advocates of further abuse and rights violations. Here in New York, Mayor Eric Adams on Monday announced the city would be shutting down the Roosevelt Hotel shelter for asylum seekers. The sites house some 173,000 immigrants since it opened in May of 2023, in response to the thousands of asylum seekers who were bused to New York City from the southern border.
We are announcing that the Roosevelt Hotel, which has served as both our asylum arrival center and a humanitarian emergency response and relief center for nearly 2 years, will be closing in the coming months.
The hotel's closure comes as Mayor Adams has promised to shutter dozens of other emergency migrant shelters by June. Adams has been accused of accepting a deal, a quid pro quo, to help enforce Trump's mass deportation policies in return for the Department of Justice suspending corruption charges against him. On Friday, a New York judge rejected calls from the Department of Justice to immediately close Adams' case, but ordered the trial to be delayed indefinitely. Adams on Monday shrugged off mounting demands for New York Governor Kathy Hochul to remove him from office, which Hochul said last week she would not do.
No, I wasn't concerned about being removed because I knew I did nothing wrong.
Farm worker and environmental groups are suing the Trump administration over its removal of climate change-related information on the USDA's website. The lawsuit accuses the USDA of harming farmers' livelihoods by deliberately withholding crucial information on federal loans, conservation practices, and climate adaptation strategies. Earth Justice, one of the legal groups that filed the lawsuit, says its outcome could have major implications across all federal agencies. Trump's White House removed over 8,000 government web pages since coming to power. And Leila Swaif, the mother of jailed Egyptian-British author and activist Ala Abdel Fattah, has been hospitalized in London after nearly 150 days on hunger strike. The 68-year-old human rights activist, mathematician, and mother began her hunger strike as part of a campaign demanding the British government pressure Egypt for the freedom of her son, Alaa. He was due to be released from prison last September after 5 years behind bars over unfounded charges of spreading false news. But Egyptian authorities have refused to count more than 2 years Alaa spent in pretrial detention toward time served, meaning Alaa likely won't be released until 2027. Professor Leila Swaif has lost nearly 70 pounds, consuming nothing but herbal tea, black coffee, and rehydration salts since last September. To see our interviews with Leila Swaif and Alaa Abdel Fattah, go to democracynow.org. And those are some of the headlines. This is Democracy Now!, democracynow.org, The War and Peace Report. I'm Amy Goodman in New York, joined by Democracy Now!'s Juan Gonzalez in Chicago. Hi, Juan.
Hi, Amy, and welcome to all of our listeners and viewers across the country and around the world.
We begin today's show looking at growing resistance to Elon Musk's demands and threats to the federal workforce and how reporters are disputing the cost-cutting claims of his so-called Department of Government Efficiency, or DOGE. On Monday, a federal judge temporarily blocked DOGE from accessing private information at the Office of Personnel Management and Education Department. Also on Monday, a different federal judge said the way DOGE is operating may be unconstitutional since the Appointments Clause of the Constitution requires leaders of federal agencies to be nominated by the president and confirmed by the Senate, and Elon Musk was neither nominated nor confirmed. This all comes after the Trump-appointed heads of key agencies, including FBI Director Kash Patel, Director of National Intelligence Tulsi Gabbard, Secretary of State Marco Rubio, Defense Secretary Pete Hegseth, all told their workers not to comply with the demand Musk made on Saturday to all 2.3 million federal workers. On a social media platform X, Musk wrote, quote, consistent with President Donald Trump's instructions, all federal employees will shortly receive an email requesting to understand what they got done last week. Failure to respond will be taken as a resignation, unquote. In response, the president of the American Federation of Government Employees called Musk unelected and unhinged. Meanwhile, President Trump backed Musk's plan, calling it a, quote, pretty ingenious idea, and said workers who don't answer would be, quote, semi-fired or fired, even as the Office of Personnel Management contradicted him and said responses were voluntary. Elon Musk doubled down on Sunday, writing on X, his social media platform, quote, a large number of good responses have been received already. These are the people who should be considered for promotion, unquote. Critics noted a promotion would then make them probationary, and Musk has directed federal agencies to fire probationary workers. For more, we're joined by two guests. Stephen Engelberg is ProPublica's editor-in-chief, which is as a team of reporters covering Donald Trump's second presidency. And in Philadelphia, we begin with a federal worker at the Department of Veterans Affairs, where the Trump cuts already led to the dismissal of more than 1,000 newly hired workers, including nurses, doctors, and other workers. Letitia is using only her first name for interviews, in part out of fear of reprisal. She's also a member of the American Federation of Government Employees. We welcome you both to Democracy Now! Letitia, let's begin with you. You work at the Department of Veterans Affairs. All 2.3 million federal workers have gotten this message. They have to say what they did this week. And if they don't respond, they will be considered resigned. Except that a number of different agency heads said you shouldn't respond to that email. And yet President Trump says it was an ingenious idea. Can you explain the kind of chaos in the Veterans Affairs Administration right now? How are federal workers feeling and responding?
Good morning, Amy. Thank you so much for having me and for drawing attention to this national fight. I just want to make the disclaimer that things that I share today are my personal views and of my experience, and I am not representing my agency nor my union in any fashion. The email, what did you do last week? It's insulting, it's disrespectful to the work that federal workers do every single day. As you mentioned earlier, it caused mass confusion, also concern for privacy and the security of the very sensitive and confidential information federal workers handle every single day. This is a game to Doge. This is a game to Elon. He has acknowledged that it is a ruse. And federal workers are learning and understanding that this is all a ruse, right? It's under the guise of efficiency, of accountability, but we know the rude awakening that Elon calls it, or the second dose of reality, which is his real goal, is to gut public services in the federal workforce and pave the way for privatization of public services, goods, and programs that we all need and love.
Well, Letitia, the VA is one of the largest agencies in the federal government, about 400,000 employees. What was the communication you got from VA supervisors about, if any, about what you should do in terms of this deadline that Musk imposed?
Yes. So, we were at the time, earlier part of the day, before we were then told that we did not have to reply, our union as well as our agency did direct us to comply to the request.
And what has been the morale and the of your fellow employees as you're facing this in contradictory pronouncements and claim announcements of layoffs, rescinding of layoffs? Could you talk about what the impact is on your day-to-day work?
Sure. So, including myself, as well as my colleagues, this is very distressing for us. It's demoralizing and it's dehumanizing. We know what we do for the federal government, for the American public, truly, every single day. Like, the United States Postal Service ensures that mail gets processed and delivered to every home address in the United States of America. The Consumer Protection Bureau ensures that, these corporations are held accountable and making sure that, everyday working families are not being scammed. It's demoralizing. We know that it's meant to be intimidating, to sow chaos and confusion for the ultimate goal of gutting public services and paving a way for Elon and his very wealthy, disgustingly wealthy allies to gain more profit. And it's not right. If Elon is successful, this will impact working families everywhere. In fact, it already is, right? With the loss of jobs, with the mass resignations, there will be and has already been perhaps delays in processing of claims at Social Security and Medicare. Delays will come for medical care for veterans. Our public lands will not be ready and accessible and safe for the summer and spring seasons. This will continue to have deleterious impacts for many generations to come. And I'm very happy to be a part of a group of informal rank and file workers who are fighting back against these austerity measures.
In addition to Letitia, who is a Veterans Affairs federal worker, we're joined by Stephen Engelberg, who is ProPublica's editor-in-chief, which has a team of reporters covering President Trump. In December, Stephen, you wrote an open letter to Elon Musk in which you suggested his Department of Government Efficiency read the ProPublica reporting on wasteful practices and spending by federal agencies. On Monday, you wrote a piece headlined, "The Trump Administration Keeps Citing an Untrue Stat as It Targets Federal Workers." It begins, "As the administration of President Donald Trump throws one government agency after another into the wood chipper, a startling statistic about federal workers keeps coming up. Only 6% of federal employees are working full-time in their offices. By any post-pandemic standard, it's an astoundingly low number, particularly as major American corporations move to force workers back to the office 5 days a week. It's also completely untrue," unquote. Stephen Engelberg, talk about why you dug into this one false claim among many, what you found, and how it fits into the bigger picture here, why this is so significant.
Good morning, Amy. Well, of course, we are hearing an awful lot of things that are untrue. You know, Ukraine attacked Russia, so on. I mentioned in the piece the rise and fall of the $50 million in condoms to Gaza. So there are many, many kind of false claims filtering around here. This one caught my eye because it was a bit of a sort of a kerfuffle in early December. A senator from Idaho, Senator Joni Ernst, who's a bit longtime foe of, the federal workforce's purported wasteful practices, put out a report, and it said 6% of federal workers, only 6% of federal workers show up to work Monday through Friday. And the minute that came out, it was on, there was the New York Post, you know, Hannity picked it up, Fox News, Speaker Mike Johnson, so it was everywhere. And, you know, being an investigative type, we at ProPublica do a lot of investigative reporting. I was just curious, where did this come from? And so I went to the report. The report had footnotes, and the footnote took me to something. There was a story done by Federal News Network, operation out of Washington that covers the federal workforce. And they had done a sort of completely unscientific survey saying, you know, write in if you're, you know, want to tell us about your work habits. And so they got a little over 6,000 people writing in. By the time that I got to the website, they had put an editor's note in saying, this is an unscientific survey. Everyone's self-selected. There is no possibility that this is actually accurate. In fact, the OMB has done kind of the definitive survey of this. And first of all, only 50% of federal workers can work remotely at all. So half the workforce goes to work every day, because if you think about it, aircraft carriers and veterans hospitals and so on. I mean, the doctors can't work remotely. The nurses can't work remotely. There are 5,000 sailors on an aircraft carrier. They're not working remotely. So it was obviously wrong. And then of the remaining 50%, they spend about 60% of their time at work. So this statistic was clearly wrong, clearly disproved. And frankly, I didn't think it was much of a story because, you know, there was, you know, the various, you know, fact-checking websites came out a few days later, picked up the editor's note on the story and said, look, this is just baloney. PolitiFact, you know, said, you know, pants on fire, which is the lowest possible rating for truth of a political statement. But then, lo and behold, when Trump took office, this thing started popping up again. On January 20th, it was in Trump's, fact sheet explaining why they're going to cut the federal workforce. And so I thought that was worth kind of honing in on it and sort of explaining to people. The first, you know, iteration of this, the report, might have been a bit of sloppy research, you know, a misreading of a story and a footnote by somebody writing a report. But the second iteration of it was not. That was done with malice aforethought. And I thought that was worth stopping and telling people. So that's why I did the story.
And Stephen, I wondered if you could talk about the status of DOGE, what exactly it is. One of your articles in ProPublica says, if DOGE is a federal agency, it can't shield its records from the public, which the Trump administration has been doing. But if it's not an agency, then DOGE's tens of millions of dollars in funding weren't legally allocated and should be returned. Some people are contending. Can you talk about this limbo area that DOGE exists in?
I think the way they're handling it is, you know, despite the public statements about transparency, to limit any transparency. As your viewers no doubt noticed, when they were sort of challenged on this, they began putting up some notion of what they're doing. You know, talk about, tell me five things you did last week. DOGE began reporting some of the things they've done and said, look, we've saved $55 billion, and it turned out it was nowhere near that. So I think this is designed. You know, you'll notice they've gone round and round on who even runs DOGE. I mean, you know, at one point, obviously, the president said, I'm appointing Elon Musk to run this thing. When they began to notice that maybe that might have legal implications, they announced that, no, he's not running it at all. But they won't say who is running it. It walks like a duck. It quacks like a duck. It's a duck. I mean, this is a federal agency. It's wielding arguably the most power than any federal agency has ever wielded. I mean, when other presidents who were, skeptical of the federal workforce became president, the Office of Personnel Management, which runs as the HR sort of arm of the government, they were not able to fire thousands upon thousands of workers at a stroke. So I think it's pretty clear, and I think that ultimately this will be concluded, that DOGE is a federal agency, and whoever is running it is the leader of an agency, and that's going to have a lot of implications.
I wanted to go to a video that ProPublica and Documented obtained from a 2023 speech by the now, well, director of the Office of Management and Budget, Russell Vogt, who is considered one of the chief architects of Project 2025. He spoke at a private gathering at the pro-Trump think tank Center for Renewing America. Here, Vogt is describing his goal of defunding federal bureaucracies.
We want the bureaucrats to be traumatically affected. We want, when they wake up in the morning, we want them to not want to go to work because they are so, they are increasingly viewed as the villains. We want their funding to be shut down so that the EPA can't do all of the rules against our energy industry because they have no bandwidth financially to do so. We want to put them in trauma.
So, Stephen Engelberg, talk about the significance of what Russell Vogt, now once again head of OMB, said.
I think it's incredibly important. I mean, it's a funny thing. You know, you do a lot of stories in the run-up to an election, and I remember that one fairly vividly. And I thought, you know, that it was chilling. It was important. We played it up a lot. But I also wondered if this was a sort of rhetorical flourish, as these things sometimes are. That is not a rhetorical flourish. You listen to that and you look at what's happened and you can see that is the game plan. Whatever they said during the campaign about 2025 is not really, you know, what we're going to do. I think it's turning out. It is exactly what they were going to do. And in particular, that one clip gave us as much of an insight as any into this kind of abstract thing that they say, well, it's a unitary executive. I mean, this is a sort of fairly fringe legal argument that now is at the center of our country, which is that you don't really have any independence in the executive branch. The president leads the executive branch, and therefore he can hire and fire anybody at any time. There are some things where we have a level of norms, right? I mean, generals can get fired. That previous presidents have fired various senior generals, so you can't say that was against the law. But then you have other things like the Consumer Fraud Protection Bureau, Consumer Finance Protection Bureau, CFPB, or the EEOC, which are independent agencies, and laws suggest that you can't just fire the people that run those. And the argument here is, yes, you can. The president is the president. Separation of powers means that everybody who works for the executive branch under any circumstances, inspector generals, you name it, they're all subject to dismissal immediately by the president, since he has what, you know, he himself, I think, is now referring to as king-like powers. And that is what is driving this. And Vogt is an architect of that viewpoint. So I think that clip turns out to be one of the most important things we did in the run-up to the election, far more important even than we understood at the time.
I wanted to ask you also, you've been tracking quite a few of the employees of DOGE. Many of them have not gotten much attention. One of them that you've tracked was a woman by the name of Catherine Armstrong Loving, who's been apparently attached to EPA. She turns out is the sibling of Brian Armstrong, who runs the industry crypto company Coinbase, which, by the way, donated, as you mentioned, $1 million to Trump's inauguration fund. How's this square with Trump's promise to drain the swamp?
Well, I mean, I think, you know, we're going to be learning more and more as time goes on. You know, it certainly appears that the hiring of people working for DOGE went through the sort of personal networks of various people, you know, people who worked at Palantir, other kind of Silicon Valley things, people from SpaceX. It is not the slightest surprise, I think, to anybody that some of these folks are going to turn out to be siblings, friends, and allies of various contributors. The problem here, again, is that if you're going to give this group of people absolute power and there is no transparency, how is the public to know, you know, when they stumble slash walk straight into an obvious conflict of interest? I mean, there's so much going on. You know, there was a moment there where somebody found a contract that the State Department was going to buy $400 million worth of Teslas. And then it was quickly sort of erased. And Trump keeps saying, well, we just won't let Elon do anything. It's a conflict of interest. But if you look at the range of his companies and his wealth, It's most of the government. I mean, you know, it isn't just cars. It isn't just rockets. You know, Neuralink is a company that has major sort of oversight from the Food and Drug Administration. And he's trying to, you know, create this, you know, cutting edge technology relating to the brain and so on and so on and so on. So, I mean, there's nobody home. They fired the main government ethics officer. I mean, I think that's saying it with words. You talk about draining the swamp as a thing, but let's not look at what you say. Let's look at what you do.
We're going to end with Letitia. Letitia, you are a federal worker with the VA, a very vulnerable population. I mean, the highest in any group of people, the highest number of suicides every day. I hear about the slashing of the LGBT office within the VA. If you could start off, though, by talking about the racial composition of federal workers.
Yes, Amy, that's a great question. So first off, I do want to share that about 30% of our entire federal workforce are U.S. military veterans. And my understanding is that about 1 in 5 of all VA employees are veterans as well. So, you know, not only do I serve veterans in my capacity, I work alongside them as well. You know, these veterans are the supporters of their families and bring in income for many of our working families. So it will have a deleterious impact on them. Namely, excuse me, there is a long history of Black workers in the public sector. Since 1861, the federal government has been employing Black workers. Post World War II, actually, there were about 150,000 Black workers within the federal government. And these folks were lobbying. They were organizing to make sure that everyone in the federal government had more fair working practices, safer conditions, and stronger collective bargaining rights. Today, 20% of all Black workers in the United States of America work within the public sector, earning a living wage, living with more stability, and importantly, receiving life-saving, life-changing benefits. In fact, 25, if I'm not mistaken, 25 or Black workers in the public sector make about 25% more than those in the private sector. This will have a major impact on Black families specifically. Black families cannot afford to lose these jobs. As a predominantly working class population, we have to fight resist DOGE and these austerity measures in the larger fight for racial justice and as well as the larger fight to save our democracy.
Tisha, we want to thank you for being with us, a federal worker with Veterans Affairs, member of the American Federation of Government Employees, and Stephen Engelberg, ProPublica editor-in-chief. We'll link to your piece. The Trump administration keeps citing an untrue stat as it targets federal workers and the other pieces that you've been involved with. Coming up next, the private company running the migrant detention center in Guantanamo has a history of abuse. Stay with us.
You gotta find your people, the ones that make you feel all right. But can you wanna stay up with all night? You gotta find your people, the ones that make you feel whole. They won't leave your side when you lose control. The ones that don't let you lose your soul. You gotta find your people, the ones that get the joke, who understand what you're saying for a word is spoke. You gotta find your people to put the needle in the groove.
Find Your People by Drew Holcomb and the Neighbors. This is Democracy Now!, democracynow.org, The War and Peace Report. I'm Amy Goodman with Juan Gonzalez. Secretary of Defense Pete Hegseth's visit in Guantanamo today and his first visit to the notorious naval base since he was confirmed and amidst growing criticism of the transfer and detention of migrants there. On Monday, the Trump administration halted plans to house detained migrants in tent structures at Guantanamo over concerns the facilities don't meet detention standards set by ICE, that's Immigration and Customs Enforcement. The tents lack electricity and air conditioning. Earlier this month, Secretary of Homeland Security Kristi Noem visited Guantanamo days after the first detained immigrants were flown there and claimed without evidence that people deported there were dangerous criminals.
These individuals are the worst of the worst that we pulled off of our streets.
Who are they?
Murderers, rapists. So when I was there, I was able to watch one of the flights landing and them unload about 15 different of these criminals. Those were mainly child pedophiles, those that were out there trafficking children, trafficking drugs, and were pulled off of our streets and put at this facility.
So that was Kristi Noem, now the head of the Department of Homeland Security. The New York Times just had an expose on a woman in Colombia who's Venezuelan, who saw her brother in video coming to Guantanamo. And she said, my brother is not a dangerous criminal. He came into the United States. The administration talked about the tattoos, that these people are members of gangs. And she said his tattoos are of Michael Jordan, because he loves Michael Jordan. Well, last week, as the Trump administration abruptly deported 177 Venezuelan migrants who'd been detained at Guantanamo, they admitted that 50 of them had no criminal record apart from entering the U.S. unlawfully. Meanwhile, five Senate Democrats, led by Senator Dick Durbin of Illinois, sent a letter to President Trump Monday challenging the transfer of migrants to Guantanamo as illegal and unjustified, calling the move, quote, unprecedented, unlawful, and harmful to American national security values and interests, the letter says. It goes on, there's no basis in U.S. immigration law for transferring non-citizens arrested inside the United States to a location outside the United States for detention prior to or for the purpose of conducting removal proceedings, unquote. We turn now to a new investigation that reveals how the private corporation running the migrant detention center at Guantanamo has a history of rights abuses at other migrant detention facilities in the United States. The conglomerate is called Akima. It has over 40 subsidiaries and more than 2,000 contracts with the U.S. government. Last year, the Biden administration awarded a contract to run the Guantanamo Migrant Operations Center to Akima subsidiary. We're joined here in New York by investigative reporter Jose Olivares, whose latest piece for The Guardian is headlined Revealed, U.S. Firm Running Guantanamo Migrant Jail Accused Over Rights Abuses. Jose, it's great to have you with us. Lay out what you found.
Thank you so much, Amy. Yes, so obviously the Guantanamo Naval Base has a long history, and it's notorious for the military prison that has housed war on terror detainees. There's been allegations of torture and abuse there. But what really the public didn't know too much prior to Trump's executive order, is that for decades, there has existed a migrant detention center at the Guantanamo Naval Base. Now, this facility is divided into two. One part of it is run by the State Department, and the other part of it is run by ICE, Immigration and Customs Enforcement. Now, ICE, what I found is that last year, the Biden administration gave the ICE contract to Acoma Infrastructure Protection, which is this massive, massive federal government contractor. And this contract is worth $163.4 million to run the Migrant Operations Center, which is what it's called. Now, technically, it is at the Naval Base, so it's extremely secretive. We don't know how operations take place, what the conditions are like for migrants there. But what's important to note is that for decades, this facility has been used to detain migrants, primarily those who are fleeing from the Caribbean, trying to make it to the U.S. and are intercepted at sea by the Coast Guard. Now, when they are intercepted at sea, they're sent to the Migrant Operations Center, where they are held and detained and processed, and sometimes either deported back to their home countries or repatriated to third nations. However, what I found with this investigation is that for decades, since the early 2000s, since the Bush administration, private contractors have been running this detention center. First, it started with Geo Group, one of the biggest private prison companies in the U.S. Then it moved to MVM Incorporated, which is a defense contractor. And now last year, the Biden administration gave Acoma this massive contract to run the facility for at least 5 years. What is also important to note here is that because it's on the naval base, it is extremely secretive. So we didn't know that throughout this, you know, various presidential administrations, from Bush to Obama to Trump to Biden, and now under Trump again, migrants have been held at this ICE facility that is at Guantanamo. There's been no public oversight over the facility. There haven't been any public reports, even though they're congressionally mandated by members of Congress to publish reports about the conditions in the facility. But what I also found is that this company, Acoma Infrastructure Protection, is part of a larger conglomerate called Acoma. And Acoma has over 40 subsidiaries. It's a massive, massive company that contracts with the government. And this company also runs other immigration and customs enforcement facilities throughout the U.S. I was able to find at least five of them, and three of them were, you know, really widely criticized for their conditions inside and for the treatment of migrants around the U.S.
And Jose, who runs this company, and how did it manage to gather so many federal contracts? You talk a little bit about its history and its the personalities involved, if any, that you found.
Absolutely. So the history of ACOM is actually quite fascinating. It's a member of the Nana Regional Corporation, which is an Alaskan Native corporation. Now, Alaskan Native corporations were created in the 70s. They were created sort of in response to protests and social movements in order for the federal government to kind of grant indigenous people in Alaska federal contracts and just more opportunities, you know, within their communities. And so the Nana Regional Corporation, it is owned by primarily indigenous people in Alaska. It is an Alaska Native corporation, so all of the shares, all the everything is owned by Native Alaskan people. But within the Nana Regional Corporation is Acoma, and within Acoma is these 40, you know, different subsidiaries. And these 40 different subsidiaries have dozens upon dozens upon dozens of federal government contracts. They work with dozens of federal agencies. They work with the Department of Defense. They work with the Department of Interior. They work with ICE. I found one instance in which Acoma, one of Acoma's subsidiaries, was hired to do maintenance of helicopters in Saudi Arabia for the military, but also to train Saudi military forces. Just different IT services, infrastructure. So it's a massive government, federal government contractor. However, because it is an Alaskan Native corporation, the shares for the company can't be traded, they can't be sold. So it's able to sort of escape any sort of regulation from the Securities and Exchange Commission. But because of its status as an Alaskan Native corporation, and because of over 40 subsidiaries that Acoma has, it's able to very quickly get contracts that are supposed to be allocated from the federal government to small businesses. So they're technically a small business that is minority owned, and that's how they're able to sort of get these over 2,000 federal contracts.
And talking again about the Guantanamo detention center, what's the situation in terms of detainees, immigrant detainees there, and their access to lawyers?
Yeah, so the access to lawyers is extremely limited, and this has been ongoing, you know, for decades that the migrant detention center has existed at the Guantanamo Naval Base. Now, what's important to note is that the migrant operations center, which is what it's called, is separate from the military prison. But what we do understand from the Trump administration's actions is that migrants who were detained in the U.S. and then sent to Guantanamo for further detention, they were housed both at the military at the military installations, the military prison, and at the Migrant Operations Center. Now, this Migrant Operations Center is divided into two sections. One section is run by ICE, one is run by the State Department, but we just don't know exactly how many people are detained there because of the lack of transparency that, again, spans decades and spans various presidential administrations. Now, I think what's important to note here is that because it is at the naval base, it's in Cuba, right? So migrants who historically primarily have fled from Haiti, from Cuba, from the Caribbean, have been intercepted at sea and then have been sent to the Guantanamo facility for further processing. But we just don't know how many have been sent there. Some estimates that I saw in some of the government contracting records show that between 2021 and 2024, there have been between 4 and 40 migrants who have been detained there. But this migrant operations center, what is interesting about it and what I found with the federal government contracting records is that it has the capacity to hold 120 migrants, 120 people, but ICE requires the contractor to be able to expand the facility with a tent city to detain up to 400 migrants. So You know, there's a lot of unanswered questions here. There is a lack of transparency. We don't know what the conditions are like. And because migrants historically who have been detained there have either been deported to their home countries or sent to a third country, we don't hear too much about from the migrants themselves who have been detained there because they primarily really haven't been brought to the U.S.
And would these migrants sent to Guantanamo be counted under deportees because this is area controlled by the U.S. and Cuba? So they're just being sent there, not deported?
Correct. Yeah. So they're still under the custody of ICE and the Department of Defense.
And final question, and we just have about a minute. The human rights abuses that Acima has been found guilty of.
That's right. So three different facilities have faced severe criticism. There is one facility in Florida called the North Chrome Processing Center, which is owned by Acima. And the Department of Homeland Security, the Office of Inspector General, did a federal audit at the facility and found various instances of inappropriate use of force, including one case that I found in which guards at this facility opened the slot to the solitary confinement door of a man who was detained there and pepper sprayed him, despite him showing no resistance or threat to anybody else. There's also a lawsuit for forced labor at the Buffalo Detention Center in upstate New York. And there's also been criticism of one of the solitary confinement units in Texas that it runs.
And finally, 30 seconds, you wrote a piece for Drop Site. Biden gave Trump the blueprint to lock up 30,000 migrants in a private ICE jail at Guantanamo Bay.
That's right. Yeah, I think it's important to recognize that this deportation system, this Guantanamo Migrant Detention Center, has been passed down from administration to administration. They're really, you know, from Democrats to Republicans, there has been no significant change between administrations.
Jose Olivares, I want to thank you for being with us, investigative journalist. We'll link to your piece in The Guardian. Revealed U.S. firm running Guantanamo migrant jail accused of over rights abuses, as well as your piece for Drop Site about Biden giving Trump the blueprint. We'll also do an interview with you in Spanish after the show and post it on our Spanish website at democracynow.org. Next up, we look at the nonprofit Dawn filing a complaint with the International Criminal Court against Biden, Blinken, and Secretary of Defense Austin over Israel's war in Gaza. Stay with us.
Possession is the motivation. Looks like we always end up in a rut, trying to make it real. But compared to what? Slaughterhouse is killing hogs.
Roberta Flack, the well-known Grammy-winning pianist and singer, died Monday at the age of 88 here in New York. This is Democracy Now!, democracynow.org. I'm Amy Goodman with Juan Gonzalez. We turn now to an effort to hold the Biden administration accountable for their role in Israel's war in Gaza. The D.C.-based nonprofit Dawn has formally asked the International Criminal Court to investigate former Secretary of State Antony Blinken, former Defense Secretary Lloyd Austin, and President Joe Biden for their, quote, accessorial roles in aiding and abetting, as well as intentionally contributing to Israeli war crimes and crimes against humanity in Gaza, unquote. These crimes include those identified in the ICC's arrest warrants issued last year against Israeli Prime Minister Benjamin Netanyahu and former Defense Minister Yoav Gallant. We're joined right now by Reed Brody, well-known veteran war crimes prosecutor on the board of Dawn. Can you explain the significance of this suit as we speak to you in Geneva, Switzerland, Reed?
Sure. As you said, Amy, in November, the ICC issued warrants against Benjamin Netanyahu and Yoav Gallant for starvation as a method of warfare, for intentionally directing attacks against civilians, for the crime against humanity of murder and of persecution. But they didn't act alone. And under the ICC statute, you can also be held liable for aiding and abetting a crime. And in order to do that, you have to have assisted in the commission of the crime with knowledge that the crime was being committed or was going to be committed in the ordinary course of events. And that's what we say that Biden, Blinken, and Lloyd Austin did here. I mean, the bombs that Israel has used to destroy schools, hospitals, and homes in Gaza were American bombs that they provided. Israel's campaign of murder and persecution was carried out with political support that they ensured. And these officials were aware, as we explain in the complaint, that Israel was committing these crimes, and yet they ensured that the political, diplomatic, and military support continued. You know, our submission has 172 pages. It shows in detail how Biden, Blinken, and Lloyd Austin ensured that you know, $17.9 billion in military assistance was sent, how real-time intelligence was given, how the U.S. vetoed resolutions at the UN Security Council. And we show how, in many instances, these officials actually overruled people below them who said, you know, war crimes are being committed. You can't, under American law, under international law, you know, provide this assistance. But I think our submission shows that Biden, Blinken, and Austin are not only morally and politically complicit, but they're legally complicit.
Reid, has there been any precedent in terms of the aiding and abetting provision in the past before the court?
Absolutely. I mean, our case is based on very solid precedents. The best example is the case of Charles Taylor, the former president of Liberia, who was convicted by the special court of Sierra Leone for aiding and abetting the rebels in Sierra Leone, you know, the ones who cut off people's hands, arms, a country that he never set his foot in. And they said Charles Taylor was aware of the crimes that were being committed by his Sierra Leonean allies, and yet he continued to give them arms and he continued to encourage them. What I like to say is, imagine that a gunman is on a killing spree, and he runs into a store. The owner knows what the man is doing. He said, quick, I need more ammunition. And the owner says, here, but be careful how you use it. That's the situation we're in. These officials were aware of what was being done with their ammunition, except in our case, they also tried to stifle criticism of what the gunman was doing, and they did it again and again.
And Reid, you filed this under an Article 15 submission. What is that precisely?
So under Article 15 of the ICC's governing Rome statute, NGOs, individuals, victims can provide information to the ICC prosecutor. Now, the ICC prosecutor already has an investigation open into the crimes committed by Hamas and committed by Israeli officials. So this will go into that. You know, the prosecutor does not usually talk about what what he does with his investigation. We know that investigation is ongoing. And what we're saying is, don't just go. I mean, we're hoping that, of course, other individuals in the theater are named, but we also say, look at the people behind them. Look at the people who have aided and abetted this.
Reid, earlier this month, President Trump signed an executive order authorizing sanctions against the ICC over its war crimes investigations against Israel. Dawn
Absolutely.
Has stated that Trump's order against the ICC could subject him to, quote, individual criminal liability for obstruction of justice. Can you explain what that's about and what you're asking for regarding Trump as well?
Sure. Well, we didn't ask for it in the communication, but as you say, under Article 70 of the ICC Rome Statute, if it criminalizes and as an offense against the administration of justice, what we Americans call obstruction of justice, to, for instance, retaliate against a court officer for taking action. So here the prosecutor has indicted, Yoav Gallant and Benjamin Netanyahu, and the Trump administration has responded by levying sanctions on this man and on the court. So that really sets, I mean, the prosecutor would be well within his rights to open up an investigation of Donald Trump for these sanctions, as he would, incidentally, for the 9 years that Israel tried with three successive prosecutors to blackmail, harass, and sting them to prevent them from taking these actions.
Ree Brody, we thank you very much for being with us. Veteran war crimes prosecutor, board member of DAWN, the nonprofit which has filed the communication with the ICC prosecutor over the role of U.S. officials, Biden, Blinken, and Austin, in supporting Israeli war crimes in Gaza. That does it for our show. Democracy Now! Is produced with Renee Fels, Mike Burke, Dina Guzder, Messiah Rhodes, Nermeen Sheikh, Maria Tarasena, Tammy Warrenoff, Tarina Nadura, Anjali Hamid, Sam Alkoff, Tamari Astugio, John Hamilton, Robbie Karen, Hani Masood, Hannah Elias. Our executive director is Julie Crosby. Special thanks to Becca Staley, John Randolph, Paul Powell, Mike DiFilippo, Miguel Noguera. I'm Amy Goodman with Juan Gonzalez for another edition of Democracy Now!
Forbes Avenue is a production of WRCT Pittsburgh. The opinions expressed are those of the participants and not necessarily those of WRCT, its members, or Carnegie Mellon University. Email questions or comments to pa@wrct.org.
Hi, I'm Arjun Das. You're listening to Forbes Avenue on WRCT Pittsburgh, 88.3 FM. I'm joined today by Dave Mawinney. Dave, how's it going?
It's going great, Arjun.
Yeah, so Pittsburgh is known for many things, winning at football, losing at baseball, pierogies, steel mills, and soon enough it might be known for something new, tech startups. That's in no small part, thanks to our friend here, the efforts of today's guest, Dave Mawinney. Dave is the executive director of the Swartz Center for Entrepreneurship at CMU's Tepper School of Business, which is one of the premier hubs for startup activity in the Pittsburgh metro area. So, Dave, you're a Pittsburgh kid. Tell us how you got to startups and how'd you find out that it was a viable career path?
Oh, wow. So, I grew up a grandson of a steelworker, the son of a Presbyterian minister. So I was at the low end of the middle class. And when I graduated high school, the steel industry tanked and everybody left town. And I was seeing some people be successful in other cities. I would read Forbes magazine, I would read Fortune magazine, and they would talk about the entrepreneurs. And I would think to myself, why not? Why couldn't I pursue that? And so it was something that stuck in my head through my undergraduate education. And I was actually getting a PhD in physics at Georgia Tech. And I realized that the tech side wasn't the side that I would be the best at. It was at the selling side. And so I decided then to be an entrepreneur. And that led me back to Carnegie Mellon, where at the time it was pre-internet. You couldn't learn to be an entrepreneur on the internet. You had to go to business school to be an internet. And Carnegie Mellon had one of the best business schools in the world, and it had one of the first entrepreneurship programs in the world. In 1971, the president of the university, Dick Seyert, hired Jack Thorne to start the first entrepreneurship program at any university. So that reputation led me here, and from that point, I launched my entrepreneurial career.
Interesting. So what was the first company that you founded?
Yeah. So a guy named Don Jones was a successful entrepreneur in the Pittsburgh area, and he gave $1 million in 1989, which was a lot of money in 1989, to found the Don Jones Center for Entrepreneurship at the Tepper School of Business. I was very fortunate to be a student at the Tepper School at that time. It was called GSIA, the Graduate School of Industrial Administration. And I said, that's the guy I'm going to start a business with. So I stalked that poor guy. And so there was an event downtown. It was called Entrepreneurs Day. And there was, you know, it was like a trade show. But they had a VIP lunch. And you had to pay to get into the VIP lunch. So I snuck in the room and found the table with Don's name on it. I took two chairs and I put them up like to save the chairs. I snuck back out of the room, and it was like festival seating. So I ran and I snuck and got first in line at the door. And so they opened the doors and I ran to that table. And I sat there with my arm on the table with the chair so no one took that chair next to me. And Don came in and I jumped up, "Don, sit here." And so he came over and sat down right next to me. And at the time, he said he was going to retire from startups. And so I worked through the lunch to get my courage up. And I was nervous as hell. And finally, I looked at him. I said, "Don, entrepreneurs never retire. You're going to start another company, and you're going to start it with me." And he started to laugh at me. But it wasn't like he was laughing at me like I'm an idiot. It was like, "I can't believe you had the cojones to ask that question." And that started the relationship. And literally, we started the company while I was still a graduate student here at Carnegie Mellon, and it was called IndustryNet, and it grew in time to be the largest business.